by really sticking to our knitting. And, you know, we tell our sales guys, like, you know, don't, there's an internal joke, don't go chasing enterprise. Like, don't do it. We're not going to support it. And I think that it's hard and it requires discipline, but I truly believe that there is a chronically underserved, segment of the market that if we stick to our knitting, we're really uniquely positioned to be able to serve well.
This is SaaS Scaled, the podcast where data meets action, with host Armon Shrocky. Each week, Armon will be sitting down with CEOs and industry leaders from the technology sector, giving you the insight to innovate without reinventing the wheel. They'll discuss challenges, best practices, and how to identify the right metrics. So if you want to get to market faster and in a way that matters, then subscribe and join us every week as we discuss SaaS scale. This episode is brought to you by Curvey, the modern no-code analytics solution, the tools you need to take action with your data on a platform built for maximum scalability, security, and cost efficiencies. If you're ready to reduce complexity and dramatically lower costs, then contact us today at curvey.com. That's Q-R-V-E-Y.com.
Hello, welcome to another episode of SaaS Scaled. And I'm here with a very good guest, actually, that from one aspect would be very special, and that's the attention they have on a domain and a market that people are afraid of that market and don't want to get there and make it work. Andrew, welcome to the show. Please tell us a little bit about yourself, your company, and what you guys do.
Sure. Thanks for having me. As you said, I'm Andrew Stern. I'm the CEO and co-founder of Quilt, which I'm sure we'll talk about. I live here in New York City with my wife and my rescue dog, who I would be happy to spend the rest of the podcast talking about. But we're here to talk about Quilt, which is a company that serves software for small independent specialty retailers. And as you pointed out, you know, we are really perhaps bucking a trend by focusing on the small part of that. Our average stores per customer is 1.1. So, you know, we have 18,000-19,000 customers and, you know, average of 1.1 stores per customer. So we really are talking about the little mom and pop, you know, the shops that line the main streets of America, the music shops and the thrift stores and pet food stores. And yeah, we serve them well, we think. Happy to talk about it.
Fantastic. Yeah. Logically, if you think about really a small versus larger transactions and think about number of transactions to be a small and large, there are only two cases out of four logical, you know, cases that are successful. Either you have to really, I mean, practically, of course, everyone wants to sell as, you know, the average deal size to be larger possible and the number of transactions to be more. But the logically and practically, either you position yourself in a smaller deal, but a lot of them to be successful, or you go after larger deals, but not so many of them to be successful. And to be honest with you, it's easier to make it work on this ladder. So you go after 200K, 500K deals, and then you close a few of them, and then you have a good quarter versus you, like you guys do, thousands of customers at a very small kind of number. And still you have to, you could make it really successful. What is the secret sauce there? And how do you guys do it? And how do you think about it?
So you're absolutely right. I will say that the advantage of having thousands and thousands of small deals is as you get to scale, the law of large numbers kicks in and it becomes very easy to predict your business, right? So, you know, there was an ongoing joke with me and my CFO in the early days when I would ask how the month was going. And he would say, Andrew, just like last month, because, you know, you're like, you don't know exactly where you're going to get the hundreds and hundreds of logos every month. But, you know, again, just as you get better at predicting, you know, every dollar of you know, marketing is going to produce a certain number of leads, is going to produce a certain number of demos, is going to produce a certain number of closes. And at scale, that becomes very, very predictable, which honestly makes it really nice to run the business. Because when you have predictability, you can make investments and you can hire people and you can, you can really play off that predictability. So I will put in that plug for serving the small guys. But I will also acknowledge that it is not for everyone. And to your the point you were making, you really have to commit, right? You don't want to be a company that's tooled for small businesses trying to serve someone large, and you certainly don't want to be, someone tooled for serving larger customers, trying to apply that to, you know, the tiny shop on the corner.
Yeah, no, definitely that's the big plus, the predictability. But also in general, when you are really serving a real need of the market and you have built a good, profitable, growing subscription business, that's invaluable. That's great. That's really fantastic. Everybody dreams about it. Now, in your case, since it's the deals are smaller, building that subscription business and leading it to either be profitable in the future or profitable today, but growing, that's something that is not easy to do, because you have to add a lot of small deals to get where you want. But you know that every quarter, every year, you are better than the previous year because you're just adding to these subscriptions. Is it fair to say that requires more investment, more money to get there because you are targeting a smaller deals? Or from your perspective, no, it's an independent factor.
I don't think it requires more. I mean, I think, look, historically, one of the knocks on serving small businesses is the customer acquisition cost, right? Or I guess more specifically, the customer acquisition cost, you know, against the long-term value, right? That CAC LTV. Yeah. It does require some scale to get that CAC to LTV down. We have done that at Quilt. We've kind of reached the point where we have a very, very efficient machine for, for generating those leads, for creating efficiency, if you will, within that marketing and sales funnel. But there probably is some upfront investment required to do that. But once you make that, and once you have a machine that's really efficient, it's actually, you know, one of the things we've learned is that it's relatively easy for us to enter new segments, because, you know, serving a pet food store or a jeweler is very, very similar to serving a music shop or a thrift store or a knitting store. And so we're able to kind of, yes, they require a slightly different message about the unique value proposition for the software for that segment, but it's, you know, that script can be dropped into the exact same machine that is creating content to generate leads, to generate a call, to generate a demo. And we're basically just feeding slightly different versions of the same script into that machine. And we're able to, you know, we think we can serve kind of N different industries, right? There's not like a theoretical limit to how many segments we can serve because we built this machine that's capable of serving them now quite efficiently.
So in other words, what you say, what I hear is that the first segment to really, be successful in that segment is the most difficult one. The second segment, you add the third segment, you add as you go forward, you can make it faster, even if it's not easier, but you can make it faster to go after other segments and add it. Now, it brings us to the question that which segment did you start when you started? How did you decide that this is the segment, let me focus on it? Or maybe you started with more generic application and then you specialized and separated the segments. Which way?
No, we did start in one. So the very first customer of our very first product was in fact a quilt store. So that's partially where the name comes from. But what we quickly realized was that, as I said, the needs of these small mom and pop shops are very, very similar. And we went from, you know, while Quilt stores do have specialized needs. So for instance, they need serialized inventory, which is a very specific kind of software, and they need the ability to manage and run classes. And there's kind of integration with some of their industry catalogs. There are very specific requirements, but we realized that quilt stores were actually quite similar to craft stores and knitting stores. And then we realized those were actually quite similar to music stores and jewelry stores. And so, as the software expanded and our ability to serve expanded, we started acquiring other specialized software platforms. And again, once we had that machine, it turns out it's the same sales motion, the same go-to-market machine to serve cheese shops and liquor stores and carnicerias and Indian spice shops and kosher delis, right? That was sort of how we wound up building the business. Yeah.
Fascinating. Now, would be a kind of a time from your perspective that, you can go back and take all of these kind of specialized domains and then introduce your next generation of software or application that essentially unify a lot of functions based on all of the experience you had. And how do you see now that we cannot not talk about this topic, AI is coming. How do you see that can also play a role in the kind of coming, generations of your software as you serve thousands of customers every day?
Yeah, we're pretty excited, honestly, about the ability of AI to both help our customers and also help us serve our customers. So, one of the things that we did really early on that unified all of our solutions was we have behind the scenes, customers don't see it, but behind the scenes, we have something called Quilt IQ that's just a data layer that normalizes every piece of information we know about all of our customers. Regardless of what point of sale software they might be using, we've got completely normalized data about all of their transactions, their usage, all of our CRM data, all of our financial data, et cetera. And this allows us to, one, run the kind of efficient machine that we talked about, but, and frankly, that's why we built it, because we knew we needed a strong underlying data layer. What it has turned out is that that is incredibly invaluable for building agentic AI solutions. Again, both for us to make us more efficient. So we've got, call deflection in our support teams and knowledge bases and predictive analytics for churn and stuff like that, but also the ability to create solutions for our customers. So we rolled out, last year, it's 2026 now, we rolled out in 2025 a marketing assistant that's kind of an agentic marketing solution for our customers. And again, these are very, very small customers. They can't afford, certainly to have a full-time marketing person, but even some of the, expensive point marketing CRM type solutions, but bundling into our software a pretty good, tightly integrated, agentic marketing AI is really, really powerful for them. And we're going to continue to roll things like that out for them to help them with inventory, to help them with operations, help them with personnel. So we're pretty excited about that.
That's great. Now you talked about, of course, services added to the software. So even the software you're getting subscription for, but at the same time, do you see, or maybe you are doing right now, also providing them or selling them intelligence, selling them data in a way, meaning that, for example, benchmarking something. And then if I'm one of the 1,000 customers in this particular vertical, without, of course, sharing anybody's data with anybody else, but providing some kind of benchmarks that I know in my industry from which aspects I'm above average or below average and what things are happening, that would be very valuable. Are those kind of things that also, from your perspective, is either today or future, in addition to software?
I do think it's in the future. And I think an important distinction, one of the things we learned early on is that selling reports back to our customers or selling data back to our customers is not interesting to them. Because again, this isn't, Coca-Cola or I guess Walmart or Macy's, yeah. right? There's no one really to be the customer for that. But if we can give them actionable and context specific information based on that data, that's very valuable to them. So a, you know, liquor industry pricing report, not very interesting, but a pricing agent that tells them, hey, you're selling Johnny Walker Blue at, you know, 20% less than, or 20% more, whatever, you're priced differently than similar size stores in, you know, locations with similar demographics, right? Or your turnover of these types of products is a lot lower than average for similar stores, right? Giving them like really actionable intelligence is something that they're excited about. So we're looking forward to rolling that pricing is a real example. That's something we actually do in the product today, but we're looking at rolling out more of those kind of AI based insights rather than reports.
That's great. The company has grown nicely. Now you are adding more customers. The company is pretty established at this moment. How the landscape has changed from your perspective as CEO today, the challenges you have compared to maybe early years of the business or not very early years of the business, but maybe a few years, some years ago.
You know, I think that a constant challenge and one that, you know, I've just been thinking about this initial question you asked me of really sticking to our knitting with the small businesses. As we get larger, we are exposed to much more opportunities. And frankly, we probably have the capacity to serve larger and larger customers. But, you know, bringing this back to where it started, I do think that there's a huge opportunity to stick to the small guys because of exactly what you said in the beginning of our conversation, which is that inevitably most software companies drift up market, right? Which is not like an insight of mine. This is, you know, Clay Christensen wrote about this 30 years ago with the Innovator's Dilemma, right? That typically software starts with lower end customers because they're supposedly less sophisticated and you have a less mature product. And then as you are able to chase those larger deals, and as you said, like, oh my gosh, I can get a $300,000 deal. I can get a $500,000. I can pay for the quarter. I can make payroll, you know, with one deal. It's very tempting to go after those large deals. And we get those opportunities all the time from, you know, sales guys that say, oh my God, I can close out my entire quarter this quarter. I can get a, you know, I can get a 50 location deal. I can get a 70 location deal. And because of that, frankly, I think the little guys are chronically underserved because the software, all the best software just sort of drifts away from them over time.
Exactly.
And so I think by really sticking to our knitting and, you know, we tell our sales guys like, you know, don't, there's an internal joke, don't go chasing enterprise, like, don't do it. We're not going to support it. And I think that it's hard and it requires discipline. But I truly believe that there is a chronically underserved segment of the market that if we stick to our knitting, we're really uniquely positioned to be able to serve well.
Yeah, no, well said, because it is tempting. And as you grow, you may want to, you know, bring bigger size deals that you can. Now you're more established, software is more sophisticated. But as you said, this can kind of, in a way, distract you from the core that you have and, you know, lose the audience. But how do you keep up with kind of so many different segments and stay focused on all of them? So, for example, jewelries don't come and say, oh, jewelry shops say, the software hasn't been, you know, really improved that much for us anymore, but you are paying attention to maybe bakeries, for example, or some other types of businesses and retailers that those are, you know, getting a lot of attention. How do you really kind of, you know, keep that equal and kind of distributed in the right way from your side?
Yeah. Well, so there's two questions there, right? One is how do we think about just running the business and allocating, you know, a dollar of capital across the different segments we serve? And the answer to that is really what we call Quilt IQ. So we look at the business, you know, every day, every week, every month. we were able to look at it across all the different segments that we serve and see, you know, how are we doing in jewelry? How are we doing, you know, how'd that trade show go? And it's all normalized, and we have a very good hierarchy of management that, you know, we have two business units and they're passionate about each of their business units. And within that, we have vertical leaders that are passionate about the segments that they serve. So there's a good kind of market dynamic internally for allocating capital. As far as, you know, updates, I would actually challenge the premise. Like, I think we're actually much better positioned to serve those customers because of our scale. So, for instance, that marketing assistant, I mean, that was like a multi-million dollar, multi-year investment for us to roll that out. The individual jewelry platform, or, you know, I'll pick on our smallest segment, dive shops. Like, there's 1,900 dive shops in the US, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's very hard to make huge, disruptive, you know, when there are major changes in technology, whether it's SaaS or AI or whatever comes next, you know, that takes millions of dollars and years to kind of keep up with that. That's very hard to justify for a market with 1,900 merchants. But when we can do that centrally and roll that out across our platforms, we can make it work, and we can give those merchants access to the kinds of tools that are typically reserved for, you know, the bigger guys, the bigger markets. But because it's fractionally shared across all of our segments, we're able to bring, I think, you know, kind of best of breed innovative solutions to market.
Do you normally, I should have studied about it before, but I didn't. So I don't know if you guys only serve the US market, North America or US market, or you are international?
It's North America today. I will say, I know that we have customers internationally. Actually, dive shops is a good example where I know there are a lot of dive shops in the Caribbean and the Mediterranean that use our solution. But for the most part, we're US dollar and English language. And so we're serving, you know, the vast majority of our customers are in North America.
And is it something that, from your perspective, that's one of the next opportunities to expand geographically to other areas and regions?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it was very intentional. We're just, you know, as you build a company, you have to sort of pick your battles, right? And be good at, be good at fewer things. So we had a very intentional choice to focus on North America, just to kind of get ourselves to scale. And as we talked about earlier, kind of build this machine that can overcome some of the traditional customer acquisition cost challenges and really build it up to scale. And now the potential to take that to other geographies is, I think it's a huge opportunity for us.
Yeah. So as a SaaS company that you're running your software, the infrastructure cost is one of the problems that many SaaS companies have. Because before COVID, it was going down. And it was economy of a scale that AWS was talking about. And actually services were getting cheaper every quarter. But then COVID happened, and then a lot of demand. And then, of course, you know, then some other things happened. And then prices started moving up. Now, from your perspective, outside even your company's perspective, but in general, thinking about SaaS, how do you see the infrastructure costs for SaaS companies can play a role, especially in a domain that they're very cost sensitive? For a retail shop, you know, even a small amount of money moving up is they're very sensitive. But at the same time, if the infrastructure cost is moving up, that would be added pressure for SaaS companies to say, okay, we don't know, we are squeezed here in between. What's your take on that and the future you see from infrastructure costs and working with more AWS and Azure and, you know, GCP and those kind of companies? Do you see that some changes have to happen in order for SaaS companies to succeed, or do you think it's good enough situation and everything looks okay, fine, no problem?
So far we are not seeing a squeeze from infrastructure costs. Mm-hmm. You know, we're very opportunistically, you know, consolidating our platforms and introducing efficiencies. So, you know, for us, we are in the fortunate position of not being in a kind of low margin business. However, you know, you asked sort of taking a step back, what do I think about the industry? I do think the real challenge in the future around infrastructure costs is the computational costs of the AI solutions that mm-hmm. are coming. You know, we're excited about them now, and they're exciting, shiny new features. But frankly, they're going to be table stakes for software solutions over the next decade. And the computational cost of delivering those is hidden right now, right? Like, we are getting massively subsidized, essentially, by these industry giants pouring billions, and I think I've seen some figures that it's getting close to trillions of dollars into, you know, the kind of AI infrastructure, which frankly we're able to take advantage of and leverage without really seeing the true cost of it. So I think that's, you know, a much more interesting and frankly existential part of the cost equation, rather than, you know, Amazon costs that like might or might not be growing, but aren't really, you know, they're, at the end of the day, they're not an important part of our bottom line.
Hopefully AI wouldn't be another drug that we get addicted to and then the price moves up. And
well, exactly. That's the concern, right?
Okay. I would like to ask you a totally different question, not relevant to what we discussed today, but it's a fun question. I normally ask the guests of the show that out of all of the cities that you have been, you know, there, and you have traveled and you have seen it, and you have very nice memories of that city, which city would you recommend me if I wanted to go and just take a 2-week vacation and visit? Any city that you liked?
2-week vacation in any city that I liked. Well, I have to be careful because of the podcast. I don't want to draw everyone to my favorite little undiscovered place. So I will give a very uninteresting answer, which is my wife and I went to Paris last year, and we're remarking to each other, you know, it's pretty hard to beat Paris. There's a reason that it is the cliche most beautiful city in the world to visit. And it is well deserved. So I'll give you a very unoriginal but incredibly defensible answer that you can't go wrong spending a few days in Paris.
And what was the best part of it? It was food. It was the nature part of it. People.
Definitely the food. Yeah. I mean, you can't have a meal in Paris. So and in particular, again, unoriginally, I will say that the bread and that just generally the pastry is pretty unbelievable.
Yeah. And then my last question would be about a book that you would like to, you know, recommend it to the audience because you either personally or professionally like that book and it was impactful to what you do.
I will say, keeping on our theme, I will say a book that's, I think the only book we have floating around the office, at least in our headquarters in New York, is a book called The Fortune at the Bottom of the Pyramid. By C.K. Prahalad. It was very influential to me early in my career. I lived in India and I was working on how to market to or how to serve small rural communities in the Indian countryside. And this book, The Fortune at the Bottom of the Pyramid, very compellingly made the case that while individually, you know, small and without a lot of discretionary income, collectively, the small rural population in India was a huge opportunity. Now, while not directly applicable to you know, all merchants in the U.S., particularly, I went back and flipped through it. And I was like, we can't actually apply these specific principles. But the idea of there being a fortune at the bottom of the pyramid, I think, was very influential to me early in my career, and is obviously evidenced in kind of how we're choosing to drive the company today.
Great. Thank you very much. It was a pleasure speaking with you, Andrew. Thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to SaaS Scaled with Armon Ashraghi. For show notes and any resources mentioned in today's episode, go to saasscaled.com. If you're enjoying our show, give us a 5-star review and share on LinkedIn. And be sure to subscribe for any updates on future episodes. Thanks for listening. This episode is brought to you by Curve, the modern no-code analytics solution the tools you need to take action with your data on a platform built for maximum scalability, security, and cost efficiencies. If you're ready to reduce complexity and dramatically lower costs, then contact us today at Qrvey.com. That's Qrvey.com.